Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress them on the third date guacamole? Well, good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
It's Jane Perrone here. I'm feeling so festive, I'm thinking of renaming the show On the Sledge. What do you think? That was my husband's idea. I'm blaming him. I'm not sure he is to be trusted with naming a podcast. He wanted to call this podcast Sage Against the Washing Machine. I kid you not. In this week's On the Ledge podcast, we're finding out whether houseplants really do clean the air around you, discovering one surprising thing that might be causing a lot of air pollution in your home, and answering a question about teeny tiny ferns for terrariums. Those of you who have been subscribed to my newsletter for a while might have had a shock this week because, well, hey, it actually arrived in your inbox for once. My pinky promise to you is that I will try to send one newsletter a month from now on, so please do subscribe. You can do that by clicking on the newsletter link in the top right-hand corner of janeperrone.com. I'll also include a link in today's show notes. The top news from the newsletter was my new merchandise store, full of everything from mouse mats and t-shirts to tote bags and mugs, all with the snazzy new On the Ledge logo designed by the lovely illustrator Jacqueline Colley. You can get it in black and white or in a lovely two-tone green setup. So do go and take a look at my shop. There's still 15% off for the rest of this week. So nip in there quick and grab yourself a little Christmas gift of a planty nature. The top 10 plants removing indoor toxins. 5 houseplants that'll help clean the gross polluted air. 4 powerful air purifying plants to clean the air in your home. Yes, the headlines are everywhere about houseplants and how they can literally change your life by cleaning the air in your home. The oft-quoted research in this area comes from a Dr. B.C. Wolverton, and he did some research with NASA, which came out in the late 1980s. A lot of the articles you're still reading today are based on that research, which is quite frankly often rather misinterpreted and misunderstood in the first place. But anyway, surely someone's done some more up-to-date research on houseplants and cleaning air. I'm glad to say I found someone who's doing exactly that. I spoke to Curtis Gove, who's a final year PhD student at the University of Birmingham in the UK, and he's working with the RHS doing research into houseplants and how they remove CO2 and VOCs, volatile organic compounds, from the air. In other words, air pollutants. The story behind the headlines is a little bit more complicated, so I chatted to Curtis about his research and what he's discovered about how houseplants work in terms of CO2, humidity, and removal of VOCs. I also found out the truth behind all those headlines you may have seen recently about houseplants giving you better skin. Over to Curtis to explain what he's been up to.
I'm from the University of Birmingham. I'm a final year PhD student, and I'm looking at houseplants and how they may improve indoor air quality by removing certain pollutants, these being CO2, VOCs, and NO2 specifically, although they do remove more pollutants than that. That is what I'm specifically looking at.
Curtis, I'm really glad that you're doing this because there's so many headlines about houseplants and their wonderful qualities, and I really want to believe that houseplants, you know, a couple of peace lilies in my front room will sort out my air quality. But I'm really glad that you're actually carrying out some more scientific research into this, because the research that's always quoted is that done by, I think his name's Dr. Wolverton for NASA a long time ago. And it seems about time that we get some actual, some current data on this. Tell me a bit about how you're actually measuring this and what you found out so far.
Yeah, sure. So yeah, you're correct about Wolverton. He was really the first guy, but unfortunately he may have overstated quite dramatically from his research, and the field has never really caught back up. The claims that you hear are often over-exaggerated and don't have much scientific proof behind them. And that's sort of, not blaming him specifically, but he sort of started it, and then that's what happened. But there is certainly value in plants, but a lot of the time, which we like to try and stress as well, is the fact that it's not any plant is going to provide all of the benefits, and they need to be looked at as sort of a service indoors. So a houseplant, they bring several advantages, as well as pollutant removal, which I do. They also bring advantages in well-being and productivity, and even in healthcare settings. And so they can control relative humidity by, you know, regulate relative humidity in rooms, and this improves energy efficiency indoors and reduces energy consumption in buildings, especially in offices, and obviously that's good for the environment. So as I said before, I'm looking at specific pollutants being CO2 and NO2 and VOCs we've done previously, and what we have is a small chamber that we enclose a plant in and seal. And so with CO2, for example, which is where the bulk of my research is what we do is we put in a concentration into the chamber of about 1,000 parts per million, which is a health guideline recommended by a big body called ASHRAE. And they say this is the maximum you should have over a long period, over a sort of 8 hours. So what we do is we put in 1,000 ppm and put the plant in as well, and basically see if the plant can remove, or how much CO2 the plant can remove in a period of time at different light levels. Because with CO2 specifically, light is very important. That's not the same for all pollutants. And what we found is that actually you need a very high light level. So in normal rooms, normal sort of room environments, you may not get enough light to see any significant CO2 removal. Although on the flip side of that, what we found is that a lot of people always ask me, are they just respiring CO2 in the evening and when there's no light, and is this detrimental? And we found that it certainly isn't. And at high light, which you possibly could get on a windowsill and in offices where we could have sort of specific installations with LEDs, I'm sure you've seen green walls and they have specific lighting on them. And a similar thing can be done there. And we found quite decent removal by certain species, especially peace lilies, at this high light level that could influence room level. But that's not to say that plants, they need that light. That's specifically for CO2. If you take benzene, for example, VOC, it's been found that in the light and the dark, the removal is almost the same. So it's very specific on each pollutant.
So how many plants do I need to be looking at having in an average-sized room in order to get a sort of measurable benefit from a plant? Does it depend on the plant? I mean, that's probably a very sort of blunt question, but you know, and probably one that as a scientist you're not going to say it's six or whatever, but I mean, is there, you know, is one or two plants going to do it, or do you literally need to have like a living wall in your front room to make this work?
Like, I get this question a lot, as you can imagine, and yeah, it's not a couple plants in your room for pollutant removal is it, and especially with, I can't say this for all pollutants, but certainly with CO2, it's not going to make a huge difference. And as I said before, it needs to be looked at a building service. And really where we found improvements for CO2 is with walls, as you suggested, because you can get a much higher density of plants in a small space. But that's not possibly, that's more of an office, that's not something that people would have in their homes, or at least not at the moment anyway. But who knows, in 10 years or so, maybe that it will be more sort of domesticated like that. So for CO2, Yeah, so you need a quite a large number of plants. We're looking at sort of 10 plus of sort of the best plants to sort of to really sort of try and because the biggest creator of CO2 indoors is us, so humans. So you know what we breathe. So trying to offset a human's contribution, you're looking at a lot of plants for CO2 and at the right light level. But it doesn't say that there are numerous pollutants that they've been found also to sort of with particulates, but it's certainly the case for pollutant removal, we think, where having a couple of plants in your room, although it's not going to be detrimental, it's not quite what's been publicized in the media and what you see a lot of, that a one house plant will do a lot. And we've also found that species difference is massive. You know, the CO2 removal can vary sort of 50-fold between certain species. So, again, this is something to consider. But, you know, we don't want to put a downer on this, you say, on plants. There's still positives from this. But I think we just have to try and be careful and sort of row back from claims that you hear a lot. You know, the claim I hear a lot is that plants improve the air. And it's so vague, if that makes sense. You know, they improve air. I mean, it could be over 200-300 specific pollutants in the air at any one time. As I mentioned before, each one is completely different from studies that have been done. They react differently to each plant. They're removed differently by each species, remove each one differently. So it's very complex. And it's easy to say that they improve air. And they do remove these pollutants, and with VOCs, they do remove pollutants at in situ concentrations, sort of room concentrations, and also at normal light. But it's just, yeah, the research hasn't really caught up with the claims.
Are peacelilies kind of at the top of the CO2 removal scale? And then what plants are terrible at removing CO2? Are there particular, is it cacti and succulents, or what's not very good at? Not that I'm kind of going to buy plants according to how good. I don't really care, to be honest, when they're removing CO2 particularly, but because I hate peace lilies, I have to say I'm not a big peace lily fan. But I'd be interested to know what are the plants at the bottom, and do they have any, and which are the plants at the top, and do they have any common characteristics? Like, is it to do with, I mean, because I'm just thinking about lots of cacti, without getting too technical, but I know lots of cacti and succulents use CAM photosynthesize to have a different way of photosynthesizing. Does that affect their CO2 removal skills, if you see what I mean?
Yeah, no, well, we haven't tested specifically whether CAM species is, that is what affects their CO2. But as you said, that could be. We've tested Zamiolia, the sort of succulent, I'm sure you know what I mean. So that's one we've tested for CO2, and that certainly isn't the best. And we believe that is because it's a succulent, as you mentioned, and it's just a lot slower. So what we found really is that with CO2 removal, it sort of links quite heavily to the water loss of plants. So plants that need watering more, i.e. the peace lilies, which are much more difficult than other house plants to keep and need more watering and more care, are actually the best at CO2 removal. And we found ivy as well, which is, you know, Heterohelix, which is predominantly an outdoor species, is actually also very good. And that could be because it's an outdoor species, and also it requires a lot of water. And so that's what we're finding in succulents. We've tested an epiphytic plant, Jasmania, which you see around a lot in stores, and that was also not very good, which we were surprised about, because we were thinking that with CO2 removal predominantly being through the stomata and uptake, that an epiphytic plant, which would do a lot of work through the leaves and through the stomata because of its nature, we thought would be good, but it turned out it actually wasn't. So yes, we've seen sort of the herbaceous water using plants, more vigorous species, physiologically active, that's it, more physiologically active, sort of vigorous species, are better at CO2 removal. And in turn, we've done work on relative humidity, and this means that they actually release a lot of water into the atmosphere, so they can increase relative humidity. And that's sort of, we've written a paper recently, and that's what we've looked at as well, is relative humidity. And we found that that a lot less plants are required to sort of regulate the humidity.
What I also wanted to ask you about was the headlines about plants being good for your skin. I'm presuming this is tied into the humidity issue, in that the drying effects of central heating and stuff are moderated by having plants which, as you say, regulate humidity. And was that something that you were surprised by, that the way that plants were able to do that?
A lot of people thought it was sort of a test that maybe didn't need it doing. It's expected. We know that most people know that plants transpire and they release water into the atmosphere. I think what we were surprised about is possibly the small number required. You're looking at little numbers that can actually have a big effect in a room. You know, you're talking much less than CO2, you know, five or so plants can actually have quite a significant effect of raising, because humidity should always be kept between 40 and 60% to sort of offset health issues. And having sort of, what we found is having five or six or so in quite a large office, admittedly, you know, and bigger than a room, but sort of 100-meter-cubed office can actually tip the balance there. So there is consideration, but that was just from modeling sort of estimations that we've done. But we were surprised about that. And another thing, that with the dry skin, that was, it was great that we got some media attention for the paper, and obviously it was good in that sense. So the dry skin was not actually something that we tested. That was taken by the first article written as because low humidity causes dry skin. So the fact that plants can raise the humidity was then taken as they can improve your skin.
I see. So was it one of these things where you put the press release out and then some science journalist went, oh, well, that must mean house plants are good for your skin. That's my headline.
I think so the original article is actually sort of written and inputted by the RHS, who sponsor me, and sort of, but as it's gone through media, which is good. Like, I I'm not complaining. It's nice for me, but as it goes through different sites, it's sort of been watered down more and more. it's not an untrue statement. As I said, plants do increase the humidity indoors, and therefore they would help with dry skin, but that isn't something that we specifically tested in the study.
It's fascinating how that happens, isn't it?
Seeing
the evolution of a scientific study through a press release through to how it's received by the media is a fascinating thing. And one of the joys of this podcast is that we can have a chat, and it's kind of, hopefully we can kind of get to the bottom of get it from the horse's mouth and hear from you what your research is actually showing.
Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress them on the third date guacamole? Well, good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Sick of being upsold at gyms?
My guy, you're currently a base member. For $90 more, I can upgrade you to our Shred membership. For $130 more, you'll be a Swole member. And for just $300 more, you'll reach Sweat Platinum.
At Planet Fitness, you'll get energy without the upsell. Never pushy, always free fitness training and equipment for every workout. It's fitness that fits your budget. Join Planet Fitness for just $1 down and $10 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, May 10th. See Home Club for details.
And now back to my interview with Curtis Gubb, and I wanted to find out how he got into houseplant research in the first place.
So I've always enjoyed sort of houseplants, but I never had any knowledge. So I did my undergraduate degree in chemistry, so I'm actually sort of a chemist. But my dissertation in that was to do with similar aligned to this, about houseplants and actually emissions from houseplants. So as well as removing pollutants, plants also emit BVOCs into the atmosphere. So we were doing some work on that, and my supervisors from the University of Reading at the time got funding for a PhD in a similar area. So I applied for it and, you know, interviewed for it and got it. So that's how it came about, really. But so I'm not a specialist in houseplants. And really, until I'd done the PhD, it's sort of knowledge that I've learned in the last couple of years. And it's not something that I've been doing for a long period of time. But I have really enjoyed it. And I like the way that it relates to a lot of people. Really like houseplants, and it relates to a lot of people. And people are always really interested. And I find that houseplants are becoming more and more important, I think, and especially in the building sector and the building industry. Green walls and that sort of thing are becoming more and more popular, and you're seeing them in more and more buildings. So it's and this research, sort of research in this area is really required, I think, because there's a lot of sort of false claims out there, and we want to sort of try and row back, if that makes sense, a bit from some of the claims. And it's not saying that they don't, because they do improve the air, and this is the problem. They do improve air because they are removing pollutants, but what pollutants are we talking about? Is it enough to actually affect concentrations in a room? Are they just sort of, if you paint a wall, for example, and you release, obviously, when you get that paint smell, they have low VOC paint, but you're still getting that smell, and you're still getting chemicals into the air and from air fresheners and things like that. It's raising the concentration of VOCs. So are we talking about plants being able to actually help with very high concentrations of pollutants that may spike indoors and not in a natural sort of environment? But this is the sort of research that needs to be done. And I feel, you know, but there just needs to be more of it going on.
Oh gosh, I'm going to start a rant about air fresheners now. Why do people use air fresheners? I just, like, open a window, like, just let fresh air into your house. Don't release a load of artificial smells into your house. Just open the window. I don't understand air fresheners. They just...
I was really shocked when I did my literature review. So obviously I do about indoor air quality. And I was actually really shocked about some of the things I found when I was going through scientific papers on air fresheners, and especially, I'm not sure what they're called. I think it's diffusers, the sort of fresheners with the sticks in. Although what they put on the back in the ingredients, so what the in an air freshener, there's liquid in the bottom. So what what constitutes that is what's measured by the EU and in sort of testing to make sure it's safe. But what a lot of these studies did is actually then sprayed the air freshener and then measured what concentrations. And it was something, I won't quote an exact number, but it was a ridiculously small amount of pollutants that were on the ingredients bottle were actually produced. Were actually on the ingredients bottle that were produced in the air, because obviously when it's sprayed, all the pollutants react together and create an even more dangerous concoction, more pollutants. It could be even more dangerous pollutants in the air, and that's what was found. And it's not actually on the ingredients label, but it doesn't have to be. And it's the same for diffusers. They release horrendous VOCs, especially into the air. And I was quite interested by those sort of studies, but it's the sort of thing that's sort of kept in academia, and it's not well known, and I didn't realise that. But we know that because sort of my father-in-law to be the other day, he was spraying fly spray, you know, those things that kill flies, spraying it in the room. I mean, the room was you can really smell it in the room, you know, you can taste it. So and it obviously it's killing off flies, so it's not going to be the best chemicals anyway. So I mean, and these sort of things. So yeah, I would advise anyone, if you don't use air fresheners, and especially not diffusers and not the fly sprays, because they're just, we don't know what pollutants they're putting into the atmosphere, indoor atmosphere.
I find an old-fashioned fly swatter is quite satisfying if you do need to kill any. I'm thinking, oh, that's a pollinator for my garden, so I try to waft it out
outside,
with a duster.
Yeah.
But if I've got to squash something, an old-fashioned fly swatter is great.
Or a newspaper.
Exactly.
But even at fireplaces as well, of just open fireplaces, wood burners, they're just giving off horrendous sort of chemicals indoors. And I think indoor air quality is going to be a really big thing in the next 10 years or so, because I think we're starting to realise we're going to get two more, but sort of cancer rates are going up, things like that. We're not really sure why. And I think what we're going to realise is, although we do some sort of controls indoors for pollutants, that a lot of the stuff is actually what we're putting indoors is very dangerous to our health.
I do just want to ask, to roll back a bit and ask you about, you mentioned briefly your previous research looking at the fact that houseplants actually give out something that's not, tell me more about that. I'm not going to babble on because I don't quite understand what it was you were saying, but could you just elaborate on that bit? Because that sounded really interesting.
Yeah, so plants, they also produce BVOCs, which is biogenic volatile organic compounds, which is produced by them naturally. So they do this outdoors and indoors. Indoors, from the evidence that I've seen, there is a base of sort of what is actually released, and the concentrations are very little. So there's no need to have a mass, you know, everyone panic that they're releasing a lot of BVOCs into the air. That's going to affect the room level. Certainly, the removal studies we found they remove a lot more than they would release. However, yes, they do actually release a lot of different compounds, and that's just, it can be from, I think it's not specifically from their indoor environment days, but sort of these plants obviously are from the jungle or from wherever originally, and then they produce more when they're stressed, for example, or if they, as a signaling between plants, for example, if one of them is wounded or sort of broken off, they will produce a lot more compounds, and it can be a signal between other plants as well. So they're used in nature like with others. Other animals and species, I guess, in a similar way to that. So, but they're useful for the plant itself. But yeah, there's no need to sort of panic about their concentrations.
Okay, well, I feel slightly relieved now. But it's interesting. Yeah, I guess it's motivation to keep your plants happy, in that, you know, that presumably if they're happy, they're releasing less BVOCs.
Yeah, I mean, they certainly do when they're stressed, they release more. But I think as we said, it wouldn't be sort of a room level affecting.
Right.
But it's sort of it's they're used by them as a signal and something in nature. But as I think it's from the time when they were probably outdoor plants, and they probably don't need to do it that much indoors.
I think that's still fascinating, though, that they're sending out, they're communicating or trying to communicate with other plants to say, somebody's just cut one of my leaves off. I just think that's amazing.
Yeah, exactly. So they do recognise that, and they alter their behaviour when they're stressed and when things like that happen. So they certainly notice.
That's the really interesting. I just find that fascinating that there's so much going on that we're not even aware of plants are doing, you know, in terms of taking things out of the air and also putting things into the air, which, you know, we just think, oh, isn't that pretty? And actually, there's all this stuff going on that we have no idea about.
We also test, I didn't mention this before, we test our plants in two conditions, in sort of wet conditions, but also dry, as in, because anecdotally, we know we might leave our plants a bit low and they get very dried out. So we also test them for pollutant removal in that dry. And just to say that doesn't increase, that doesn't have a detrimental effect indoors, them being dry, as in they're not releasing a lot of pollutants in the atmosphere because of their dryness. But we felt it was important to test because, as we know, we can forget about plants, and that's the state that they possibly are in a lot of the time, as well as being optimally watered. So,
well, that is so interesting. I've learned so much, Curtis. That's really fascinating. No, what's your next step? what are you going to be looking at next? Have you got any? Getting your PhD done is obviously the main requirement, presumably.
Yeah, so I'm hopefully finishing in October. But the next steps really is we're moving on to NO2. I'm sure you've heard, there's been a lot of reports recently about NO2, banning of diesel cars, in outdoor. But things seem to trickle down a lot slower towards indoor. I'm not really sure why, because we know that's where, you know, we spend Western Europe, we can often spend 20 hours a day indoors or in indoor environments as such. So it's important to know what's indoors, and we're looking at NO2 because that's under-tested in sort of indoor plants. It hasn't really been tested, and it's important because in cities especially, where there are a lot of cars and a lot of pollutants, they will easily travel indoors because obviously these pollutants are so little, they can just travel through standard cracks in buildings, or if you have the window open, for example, when you live near a road, you're going to get a lot of these pollutants inside. So an NO2 is very, very dangerous, even at small concentrations. It causes cancer, and it's a really dangerous pollutant. So it will be good to know if plants can help with NO2 indoors, because there's been studies on trees and outdoor plants, and it's shown that they can remove a lot of NO2, but this is sort of ambient outdoor tree concentration. So it would be assumed that they can also remove NO2, but at what level, we don't know. So that's what we're moving on to next to find out.
And has your research prompted you to add more plants to your own home?
Yeah, it has. I've got a lot more plants now in my home than I had before. Yeah, it's also the benefits, but also you just working with them and having them, you realize sort of how nice they are to look at. And is this anecdotally, it's been tested how well good they are for your well-being, etc., but and how they make people sort of happy and stressed. But it's certainly, I think everyone can tell when you put a plant in, people like it, and people look after it and take ownership of the plant. And yeah, that's something really important, I think. So I've got loads more plants in my house now, probably too many.
Thanks so much to Curtis for joining me and discussing his research. Check out the show notes for links to academic papers and pictures of some of the plants that Curtis has been testing. And now on to question of the week. This one comes from Alexis, who wanted a recommendation for a small fern that will remain small for a terrarium they're creating as a Christmas present for their mother-in-law. So this is a real make or break question, folks. This is also an excellent question, because so often ferns that are sold for putting in terrariums are things that will be okay in a terrarium if bought as a baby plant, but beyond a few months they're going to get too large. You even see things like asparagus ferns, which aren't exactly ferns, but also do grow absolutely massive. So if you're looking for a terrarium that will go for a long time without needing to be replanted, you really do want a teeny tiny fern that will grow slowly and stay small, 15 or 20 centimetres tall. One of my absolute favourite mini ferns for a terrarium is Hemionitis arifolia, the heart-leaved fern. It's not particularly ferny, if you know what I mean. You're not getting a maidenhair, very filmy kind of look to the leaves. They're much more leathery, but it's still a beautiful plant, and it will only get to around 15 centimetres tall. It does like consistent moisture in the potting mix, so this really is a plant that does well in a terrarium setting. Another fern I saw recently, which I think would make an excellent subject for a terrarium, is one called the eyelash fern. The Latin name is Actinopteris, and I've seen it recently on a couple of terrarium plant websites. This is another really tiny fern. It looks a bit like a very skinny flat leaf parsley. It's one that likes a little bit of drier conditions than the Hemionitis arifolia. It's not something I've grown, but I think it would be definitely worth a try for your terrarium if you can get hold of one. Another really slow growing fern is the oak leaf fern Quercifilix zeelandica. I saw this on the Glasshouse Works website, although it's out of stock there at the moment because I think it's proving very popular. But the great thing about this one is it's very slow growing, and it's another dwarf fern that would go really well in a lovely, cosy, humid terrarium. It would love the high humidity there. Unfortunately, it does seem like this plant is also proving popular in Europe as well, because it's out of stock on the Araflora website, which is often my backup site for this kind of rare plant. As the name suggests, this one has fronds that look like oak leaves. And interestingly, this is one of these ferns where the fertile fronds are very different from the rest. They stand really upright and have a much more elongated look. So you get two different kinds of fronds on one plant, which adds a little extra something. And my last suggestion isn't actually a fern. Sorry about that, but it is a very, very cool plant. It's Biophytum sensitivum. This one only gets to about 15 centimetres as well. It's actually a member of the Oxalidaceae family. And it looks like a teeny tiny palm tree. If you remember back to the James Wong episode, James was growing these in a wonderful globe-like terrarium, and they looked absolutely fantastic. And interestingly, like the prayer plant, the leaves of this biophytum will shut down at night and close up like an umbrella, which I always think is an extra bit of interest. Alexis, I hope that's given you some inspiration. You should be able to get the heartleaf fern from a wide variety of suppliers. So if you struggle with the others, go for that first choice. But do look up the others and add them to your wish list because they're all pretty fabulous. If you've got a question for On The Ledge, drop me a line to ontheledgepodcast@gmail.com. I am at your service. That's it for this week's On The Ledge. There are just two more episodes left before Christmas. Gasp! So please do tune in next Friday for another slice of On The Ledge, where we'll be talking about houseplant photography, how to get the best out of the pictures you take of your lovely leafy charges. Until then, have a fantastic planty week, and remember, whether your watering can came from the pound shop or cost you $150, the rule's the same. Hold back on that watering can unless you're absolutely sure your plant needs it, especially at this time of year. See you, plant fans. Bye! Heard in this week's episode came from The Joy Drops with Roll Jordan Roll, An Instrument the Boy Called Happy Day Kakana by Samuel Corwin, and Oh Mallory by Josh Woodward, with ad music from Heftone Banjo Orchestra with Dill Pickles, all licensed under Creative Commons. See my website, janeperone.com, for details.